The Honorable Chief Justice and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. Oyez, 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 all persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
It gives me great pleasure today to recognize the fact that this is the 30th anniversary of Justice Byron White's appointment to this court. He was appointed on April 16, 1962, and has served with distinction ever since. It's been a pleasure to have you as a colleague for that time, Justice White. We all feel that way.
You may hold the applause.
Save your applause till after we adjourn. Today's orders of the court have been duly entered and certified and filed with the clerk. They will not be otherwise announced. Mr. Clerk, the court will entertain motions for admission to the bar of the court at this time. We'll hear argument first this morning in number 91872, United States against Salerno. Mr. Feldman.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This case raises an issue concerning the proper interpretation of Federal Rule of Evidence 804B1. Under Rule 804B1, former testimony is admissible if the party against whom the testimony is offered had an opportunity and similar motive to cross-examine the declarant at the time the testimony was given. The Court of Appeals in this case held that that express similar motive requirement was irrelevant, and that the former testimony at issue here, which was grand jury testimony, was admissible under Rule 804B1.
Did the Court of Appeals question whether or not there was a similar motive?
No, they did not. The Court of Appeals, the only thing they said about whether there was a similar motive was that they agreed, I think this is almost a quote, they agreed with the district court that the government may well not have had a similar motive to cross-examine the declarants. They didn't say, I don't think there's a word in the Court of Appeals opinion, or in their later opinion in the case of United States against Bahadur, where they attempted to clarify their opinion in this case. I don't think there's a word in either opinion that suggests that they thought the government did have a similar motive.
Mr. Feldman, the district court found the government did not have a similar motive. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Was that a determination that there was no similar motive as a matter of law or as a matter of fact?
I believe that was largely a determination of fact. The district court made...
It reads as though the district court decided as a matter of law that there never would be a similar motive at the grand jury proceeding. What do you think they decided?
I think the factors that influenced the district court, a lot of those factors would probably be present in other cases, and therefore I think district courts would frequently and should reach the same conclusion that the district court did here. But the district court, when it made that decision, had before it the particular grand jury transcripts at issue here. The court had sealed materials that it referred to in its opinion.
Well, do you think it's an issue of fact?
Yes, I do think it's an issue of fact.
And so, on a case-by-case basis, the court would have to determine whether there's a similar motive.
I think that as a general matter, that's certainly true under Rule 804B1, as if the rule would be applied to a variety of different former proceedings. I think, in particular, with respect to grand jury proceedings, the answer should almost always or always be, because of the structure of the proceeding and because of the nature of the inquiry that the proceeding is undertaking, that the answer should almost always be that the government did not have a similar motive. Insofar as, in fact, I think generally the considerations as to whether hearsay grand jury testimony should be admitted against the government or against the defendant, I think that it's more profitably considered as a general matter under Rule 804B5. Where a court can look at the particular circumstantial guarantees of trustworthiness and look at the whole situation and decide whether there's some basis to think that the testimony is reliable enough to be introduced at trial.
Have the circuit courts discussed the question of the test for and the definition of similar motive, or is this still a very newly emergent doctrine?
I think it would be fair to say that it's been seen as largely a case-by-case factual determination. There hasn't been a lot of detailed legal discussion about what would or would not constitute a similar motive. The issue is whether the party against whom it's offered had a motive to cross-examine in the prior case so that that party fairly can be held to what it did with the witness in the prior case or the prior proceeding.
If the government decided that it wanted to question a witness extensively in order to lay the background perjury prosecution, but the objectives were, and the course of questioning was the same as would be pursued in the trial. Is that a similar motive or a different motive?
I think, if I understand the hypothetical right, I think it would be a similar motive. At least, if you have a particular piece of testimony that someone has given, the question is, what is the government's motive to discredit that testimony, and what is the government's motive to discredit it by confronting that witness with a full cross-examination, as opposed to by just introducing contrary evidence when the witness leaves the grand jury? And I think, regardless of whether the government would want a perjury prosecution in your hypothetical or for some other reason, if the government has a reason to discredit the witness's testimony and to fully confront that witness with full-scale cross-examination, with full-scale confrontation with the evidence against that witness, as it would do at trial, then I think it would have a similar motive.
Mr. Feldman, can I ask you a question there? It seems to me there are two different ways to phrase the question. One, does the government have any motive at all to show that the witness is a liar? It seems to me they clearly had a motive, but maybe that motive is overcome by other considerations. Is the fact that other considerations make it unwise to do what you have a good motive to do destroy the existence of the motive?
I would quibble with the question just insofar as I'm not sure that the government did have much of a motive.
They thought they were lying and that there really was this conspiracy. They surely had a motive. Maybe they didn't want to go ahead and do it. But it's pretty clear from what I understand the facts to be, they did think these people were lying.
That's right, but...
And they didn't have any motive to show that perjurers in the grand jury were liars.
Well, the government may have some motive to show that, but I think it's important to keep in mind that in a grand jury investigation, the issues are not focused on particular charges as they might be at trial, and there may be testimony that's given in a grand jury that turns out not to be very relevant or important to the government.
Well, that may be true. There may be reasons not to go forward and prove they're liars, but to say there's a total absence of motive or that's not similar to the motive of trial, I find very difficult to understand.
The rule requires similarity of motive, not total absence of motive. But in any event, let me proceed to the other part of your question. I think where the government did not cross-examine witnesses in order to preserve the integrity of the proceeding, it was not a tactical decision that the government made in order to improve the strength of its case, if you can talk about that, in the grand jury. It was a decision that the government made in part, in order to preserve the secrecy of the grand jury, to protect informants, to protect methods of investigation, for all of those sorts of reasons.
Those are all good reasons. But are they inconsistent with the fact that the motive was nevertheless there?
I believe they are. The motive, if you look at the rule is not, it's motive to develop the testimony by direct, redirect, or cross-examination. It's not motive to discredit the witnesses. And I think it's important to make a distinction between those things. It may be that the government had a motive to discredit the witnesses, although, as I said, it may be quite different from its motive at trial. But it doesn't have the same motive in the grand jury to discredit them by developing their testimony, as opposed to by, for instance, simply introducing surveillance tapes, by introducing the evidence of other informants. And in fact, it has a positive motive not to do some of those things in order to protect the integrity of the investigation itself.
Could you also, while I've interrupted you, comment on the similarity of the situation for a defense witness at a preliminary hearing where the defendant decides for tactical reasons not to cross-examine? Is there a similar motive there?
I don't really want to make broad rules for all of these things. I think at a preliminary hearing, the situation is sufficiently different from a grand jury that at least frequently the defendant will have the same motive. Where a defendant chooses for tactical reasons not to examine the witness, it's not to preserve the integrity of the preliminary hearing, and it's not to advance the purposes of the preliminary hearing, which is to determine whether there's probable cause to hold the defendant. It's for some other reason that I think more appropriately is labeled tactical. I think the situation in the grand jury is rather different. In the grand jury, the charges have not clearly been articulated or even perhaps focused on or made at the time that a witness testifies. And the positive reasons the government has not to develop the declarant's testimony relate directly to maintaining, not to advancing its position in that hearing, but to maintaining the ability of the grand jury to continue to investigate the crimes and to bring an indictment.
Mr. Feldman, don't you think a similar motive means similar in degree? You think it's enough that you have some very slight, remote motive of the same kind? Why would it make any sense to write a rule like that?
No.
If you have some vestige of a motive of the same type, although it is not remotely the same in degree, why would that assure reliability?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it does. I think that The rule requires similar motive. If you look at the notes of the advisory committee that drafted the rule, they considered identity of motive, I believe, as a possibility, and decided that similar, then they considered substantial identity, I think. I may not be right about that, but in any event,
I mean, similar in degree as well.
I think it should be similar both in type and degree. That's right.
And I don't understand your argument that you think this whole thing should be considered under B5 instead of under B1. How could you consider under B5? B5 requires that the statement not be specifically covered by any of the foregoing exceptions. You think that one that does not qualify for one of the foregoing exceptions because it doesn't come within the exception, although it is prior testimony, could nonetheless qualify under 5?
I tend to think that it can. If you look, at least, let me say this, it's not an issue that has to be reached in this case, but if you look at the way the lower courts have dealt with, for instance, grand jury testimony and so on, they have dealt with it as if it doesn't come in under one of the 1 through 4 exceptions, that it still could come under 5 if it has proper circumstances.
I mean, district court can say, well, this is really not similar motive, it's not similar in kind, it's not similar in degree, but what the heck, we're going to bring it in under 5 because we think it's reliable anyway, even though the rule says it's not reliable unless it's similar.
I think a district court could say, we're going to look at this testimony and look at all of its characteristics, including the relationship of the declarant to the defendants, to the government, the circumstances under which the declarant testified. There may be a number of other factors that are worthwhile in looking at to determine whether there's a circumstantial guarantee of trustworthiness.
Well, Mr. Feldman, is it still the law, as it was when I went to law school and when I practiced, that the trial court is given a considerable amount of discretion in deciding whether or not a particular piece of evidence is relevant or not?
Yes.
That a district court could decide some of these questions either way and should not be reversed by a court of appeals?
I think that's right. Generally, in fact, if you look at the decisions under the federal rules, the courts of appeals articulate the standard differently, but generally it's an abuse of discretion standard or something like that as to the degree of discretion the district court has to rule on evidentiary issues. In this case, I might add, the district court had before it 9 months of trial. It was quite familiar with what the issues at trial were and the contentions of the parties. It had the grand jury transcripts, it had the sealed submissions of the government, it had arguments of counsel. Based on all those things, and looking at the direct text of the rule, the district court held that the evidence was not admissible because there was no similar motive. The Court of Appeals kind of, by holding that it had to be admitted under Rule 804b1, it puts the district courts in a kind of odd situation since they have to decide, notwithstanding the fact that the text of the rule says similar motive, they now have to decide when a Court of Appeals is going to feel that fairness or something like that requires that the text of the rule be ignored or disregarded, or as the Court of Appeals said in one place, evaporate. I think that the linchpin of our argument, and I think the key point to make in this case, is that the text of Rule 804b1 is entirely unambiguous. It requires opportunity and similar motive. The opponent of the testimony has to have opportunity and similar motive to develop the testimony. The federal rules of evidence were enacted into law by Congress, and absent a holding that Rule 804b1 is unconstitutional as applied to this case, and there was no such holding by either of the courts below, nor do we believe any such holding is possible in the facts of this case, the rules must simply be applied according to their terms. The Court of Appeals said that the similar motive requirement, and in fact in one place they said the opportunity requirement as well, is irrelevant or evaporates. And we believe that since the federal rules of evidence were enacted by Congress, the specific terms of those rules have to govern in criminal cases, and the district court was correct in relying on the specific terms of that rule. What the Court of Appeals did was make up a new hearsay exception, Rule 804b6, which is where a defendant has hearsay evidence that the defendant believes is exculpatory, and where the declarant takes the Fifth Amendment and the government doesn't immunize the declarant, that hearsay testimony is admissible at trial, period. I don't find any principle of that nature in the federal rules. I think there would be a lot of reasons why a rule of that sort would be a mistake to adopt, but in any event, it's not there, and I don't think the Court of Appeals had authority, in essence, to adopt it for purposes of this case. I would add that the error that...
May I just raise one question? Of course, the availability issue has to be satisfied, though, doesn't it?
That's right.
And, of course, their theory was that the witness was unavailable, and you disagree with that.
No, we agree, actually. In fact, the predicate for getting evidence in under any of the Rule 804b exceptions is that the witness is unavailable.
Right.
Therefore, in order for the defendants to get the evidence in this case, there had to be a finding that the witness is unavailable.
Gotcha. They're unavailable to the defendant, but not to the government.
Right. The availability to the government, I think, is of no consequence here. I think the Court of Appeals was mistaken about that. But even if they were right, if the declarants were in some sense available, the consequence of that would simply be that the evidence is not admissible under Rule 804b1, because 804b1 requires, initially, that the declarants be unavailable. So I just don't follow that line of reasoning at all. The Court of Appeals' error was not merely a technical one. The point of the hearsay rules is that hearsay evidence is not admissible unless there's some specific reason to believe that it's reliable. Either it falls within one of the general categories, which have their kind of categorical guarantees of reliability, or within the residual exception. In the case of Rule 804b1, that purpose is served by requiring that the party against whom the testimony is offered have the opportunity and motive to cross-examine or to develop the testimony thoroughly. And where a party has had that kind of opportunity and motive, it provides some reason to think that the testimony is trustworthy since it's been subject to cross-examination. And moreover, the party has already done where it had the opportunity and motive. It's already done what it would have done at trial, and it's not considered to be that unfair to then introduce the hearsay testimony. I think the Court of Appeals holding eliminates the motive requirement and substitutes nothing else in its place, so that instead of the standard pattern of the hearsay rules where there be some reason to think that a hearsay evidence is reliable before it's admitted in evidence, instead of that, you have evidence that's never subject to any guarantee of reliability or any reason to think it's reliable at all. And indeed, in this case, the district court held that there was no circumstantial guarantee of reliability in considering Rule 804b5 and held that I think in its opinion that's in the appendix of the petition, that there was just no reason to think it's reliable.
Well, but as I understand the Court of Appeals saying, well, that may be, but the government has no basis to complain about that because the government has the remedy right in its pocket.
If you don't think
it's reliable enough, then give him immunity.
That's what the Court of Appeals said. I think that trenches seriously on the executive branch's prerogative to grant immunity, but more importantly, there's nothing in the rule that says, well, where a party... assertion of a valid privilege is specifically defined as a basis for a finding of unavailability in the rules. The rules don't anywhere provide that if a party somehow could make an declarant available, that then the hearsay rules just vanish, and if the party chooses not to use that power, the evidence comes in.
I suppose the government would have to tell a defendant where a particular witness is if the defendant didn't know.
I think it would depend on the circumstances, but sure. The government has Brady obligations. It complied with those Brady obligations in this case. In fact, the government informed that.
But if a witness is hiding somewhere and the defendant can't find him and the government knows where he is, you would have to tell, I suppose.
I think that that would come something under, if there's a Brady obligation to do so, I think, yeah.
And is it a Brady obligation or not?
I think under the right circumstances, yeah, there would be.
You mean not always, you wouldn't have to always tell them where the witness is?
The only reason I don't want to answer that categorically is because it might depend on the...
Well, you don't think that's somewhat similar to this situation? The government just doesn't want to immunize this person.
That's right. I think it's rather different from a situation where the government doesn't tell the defendants where the witness is. The general rule is that the executive branch has the authority and has the discretion whether to immunize witnesses. It's the executive branch that has to, in a sense, pay the cost by foregoing prosecution when someone gets immunized. The defendant has no motive to avoid immunizing witnesses so that they can later be prosecuted for perhaps very serious crimes they might have committed. In this case, the general rule is that the defendant has to bear the cost of not having access to witnesses who exert the Fifth Amendment privilege, just as the government does in cases where the government finds it not worthwhile to immunize them because the government wants to prosecute them and it would make it too difficult. The government did what it was required to do and, in essence, disclosed the identity and the whereabouts of the defendant, of the declarants were never an issue. Disclosed that to the defendants, and that's all that the government's obligation, that the government had to do in this case.
You certainly were not agreeing with Justice White that you always have a duty to tell the whereabouts of witnesses, are you?
No.
I mean, you've got a witness protection program out there, I suppose.
Right. That's what I was saying. And I don't want to answer categorically because I think it depends on lots of things, such as the defendant's real motive to find the witness and the importance of the testimony and I don't think you can give a categorical answer to that.
Did the defendant have the precise transcript of the grand jury testimony available
no.
to them?
No, the defendant didn't. They didn't have that actually until after the Court of Appeals decision.
They just had information. Did they have formal communication from you that there was exculpatory testimony?
Yes. That's what they had, and I think if you look at their, they were familiar with the industry, they were familiar with these two declarants and what their role in the industry was, and actually if you look at their papers below, I think they had a reasonably good idea of what the nature of the testimony was, the exculpatory testimony.
If this is a factual question to be decided by the district court, they're at something of a disadvantage in arguing about the motive, aren't they? Because they, I mean, the government knows what the transcript says and they don't know. Or do you propose that in these factual inquiries the defendant be given the grand jury?
No, I think as a general matter, that also that itself is a decision the district court has to make in light of Rule 6E. There's well-developed law about under what circumstances a defendant has a right to get grand jury transcripts, and lots of evidentiary decisions might be made in the district court where one party or another submits something under seal because the other party doesn't yet have the right to know what that that material was. In this case, the district court made a decision on the particular facts in this case that the defendants didn't need the text of the grand jury transcripts. And that ruling was not reversed on appeal, or not even, the Court of Appeals didn't even comment on that ruling. In short, I think the text of Rule 804b1 is clear and unambiguous. The party against whom former testimony is offered must have an opportunity and similar motive to cross-examine the declarant or to develop the testimony fully at the time the testimony is given. The Court of Appeals held that that similar motive requirement is irrelevant or evaporates in some circumstances. We think that that's a clear misreading of the rules, and that the decision of the Court of Appeals should be reversed. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time, if I may.
Very well, Mr. Feldman. Mr. Tiger, we'll hear from you.
Mr. Chief Justice Rehnquist, and may it please the Court, I hold in my hand nearly 400 pages of grand jury transcript first released to us after certiorari was granted, 280 pages of Mr. DeMattis, including 10 separate document requests with which he complied, and 75 pages of Mr. Bruno under a subpoena ducis tecum. This is the testimony of which the government said we didn't have a similar motive, and in fact, we didn't develop it. These witnesses were confronted in the grand jury with every single key witness that was to testify at trial. An indictment had already been issued in this very case. It was a superseding one that came out afterward. They were confronted with a key wiretap of Scopo, who was the central declarant in the alleged conspiracy. The Court of Appeals found that with this testimony, if it was believed by the jury, there was no conspiracy, because these witnesses were key oligopsonist players in the receipt of concrete from the trucks and key oligopolistic players in the alleged bid rigging. Without them, of course, there couldn't be a conspiracy.
Do I have the question presented wrong? I thought that, that under the question presented, we are assuming that the government lacked motive to cross-examine. As I read the question presented, it's whether federal rule of evidence authorizes admission against the government of the former testimony of a declarant who has been rendered unavailable by his assertion of his Fifth Amendment privilege, even though the government lacked any motive to cross-examine.
Under the question presented, Justice Scalia, the answer is clearly yes, because the question presented misstates the rule.
Well, it's an easy case then. I mean, we took the case to decide the question presented.
Yes. Then, Mr.
You're telling us it's an easy case.
Justice Scalia, it's an easy case on the question presented because the rule doesn't require a motive to cross-examine. It requires a motive to develop the testimony. Your question to Mr. Feldman illustrates this. This rule jettisons the common law requirement of identity of parties and substitutes the much more supple concept of similar motive. Second, Justice Scalia, as cited in our brief, we're entitled to defend our judgment on any ground, whether raised in the Court of Appeals or not. And the government brought this case here.
Yes, but we don't have to decide the case. You may present that reason, but we're not required to even recognize it.
The court has the power, Justice White, to do that.
Yes, I agree with you.
We don't ordinarily indulge in it.
Chief Justice Rehnquist, I am comfortable with the merits, but I wish to make clear that the government in its certiorari petition, filed at a time when we didn't have this material, described the case as though it had had no motive before the grand jury to talk about these wiretaps and to reveal its investigation. after certiorari was granted and we got the facts for the first time, we learned that these things did indeed happen before
but
the grand jury.
But this wasn't the ground of the Court of Appeals relied on.
No, the ground of the
Court of Appeals. Are you defending that or not?
I do defend that, Justice
White. I think
White.
You better get with that.
Yes, sir. I defend the Court of Appeals decision on its own terms as follows. For 25 years at the bar, the most uncomfortable thing a judge has ever said to me, and it's happened a lot of times, is leaning over the bench and in a tone of voice used by cats to explain to canaries the meaning of dinner, the judge says, Mr. Tiger, you have opened the door. That is to say, Mr. Tiger, evidence that you might be able to block the admission of is not going to come in because you have done things or said things or suffered things to be done or said that make mean that you can't rely on it. Now, you could go for these purposes to Rule 104A, which requires a preliminary fact kind of determination, and say that that's the rules of evidence equivalent to 37A, and use the same analysis you did in Insurance Company of Ireland versus Compagnie de Bauxite de Guinée, saying essentially that the personal jurisdiction issue is pretermitted, we don't have to get to it. Here the Second Circuit said, and it explained it clearly and narrowly, it's at page 15 of our brief, quoting from their opinion in Bahadur, that we concluded in Salerno that it, i.e. similar motive, could not be invoked by the government under the specific circumstances of this case. And when the Second Circuit so spoke, it did so having in its hands something that we did not, that is, these nearly 400 pages. When we look at them, we see that the Second Circuit was right, that the adversarial fairness goal is met here. The court in Jones against Illinois, Justice White, Justice Scalia, Chief Justice Rehnquist, also addressed this question. Nothing's more sacred, I suppose, than defending the Constitution. The exclusionary rule is a mean to do that. But if the accused opens the door, then it comes in.
I take it, your bottom line is that the government's position really requires a decision on whether the rule is constitutional.
If it isn't.
You would say.
If the government's position is accepted, Justice White,
yes.
If this adversarial fairness doctrine, which is routinely used, is not invoked, it is unconstitutional. Let me turn to that. In Chambers against Mississippi.
But no, that was never suggested, even in the Court of Appeals, was it, that it was unconstitutional?
Yes, it was, Chief Justice Rehnquist. The Court of Appeals said that it didn't want to reach the constitutional issue posed by this very issue unless it had to, and so it resolved the issue based on the concept of adversarial fairness. We briefed it in the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals responded to it in its opinion, and it is fairly presented by this record, sir. In Chambers against Mississippi, the court held that the ordinary rules of hearsay give way under certain circumstances. Then in Ohio versus Roberts, the court explained what it meant. And then this term in White versus Illinois, it took the analysis a step further. You remember in Ohio versus Roberts, defense counsel, a hapless poor fellow, went outside and he got Anita Isaacs in and he put her on direct examination to try to wheedle exculpatory testimony out of her, but didn't work. It happens to defense lawyers in preliminary examinations. That derisory encounter on direct examination was held to be such a similar motive that the confrontation clause was not violated. Again, I contrasted with these 400 pages. The court then said some interesting things. First, cross-examination, direct examination doesn't matter. I think that answers Justice Scalia's question. The motive doesn't have to be very much, and it can be direct as well as cross. And that's what the drafters of the rule thought. Second, the district judge's opinion, Justice O'Connor, you'd asked whether it was a decision of law or fact. If you look at her opinion, she said a prosecutor doesn't have a motive. She spoke in general. And then two paragraphs further on, she did something that gives it away. She said, I got some letters from the government that say these people aren't reliable. Well, in White against Illinois and in Ohio versus Roberts, this court said for government hearsay, that doesn't matter. We don't take letters over the transom or under the door that the hearsay declarant's not a nice person. If the requirements of the rule are met, here cross-examination and the development of the testimony, the most reliable according to Wigmore and all the commentators, or if in White versus Illinois the excited utterance standard is met, that's the end of it. We don't take a letter under the transom that says that the excited utterer declarant, robbed a grocery store last week. That can be shown under Rule 806 so that the government has a fair opportunity to do, even without granting immunity, that which it says it didn't have the opportunity to do.
Your position, Mr. Tiger, is that the government opens the door when it begins cross-examination in the grand jury?
No, Justice Kennedy, we do not take that position.
When does this door get open?
The door is opened, one, and the Court of Appeals...